Thank you for this opportunity to give you this talk and tell you about the very exciting time we find ourselves in physics, where we can actually use gravitational waves to uncover the dynamics of space-time. I also want to tell you some about the theoretical and computational work that allows us to know what to expect and understand what we see with this new window into the universe. So as probably everyone here remembers, it was just 2 years ago that this whole field of gravitational wave astronomy got kicked off. That happened when there was a big announcement from LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, that LIGO had detected the signal shown here, both in their instrument in Hanford, Washington, and their instrument in Livingston, Louisiana. And the signal actually represented an event that took place 1.3 billion years ago, where two black holes, each having a mass about 30 times that of our sun, spiraled towards each other, merged, formed a bigger black hole, and emitted these gravitational waves, these ripples in the fabric of space-time, where we actually measure them on Earth. And so remarkably, this whole story of black holes, what they are, what happens when they merge, and how they create gravitational waves, was actually described by Einstein in his theory of general relativity that he came up with almost exactly 100 years before this. So not only was this detection a sort of stunning validation of Einstein's theory of general relativity, it was a very fitting centennial celebration. So this was followed in succession by several other detections of binary black holes merging, including one that happened just this past August, that was detected not only by the LIGO instruments, but also by the Virgo instruments in Italy. And this joint detection actually allowed us to tell very well exactly the direction in the sky that the signal is coming from. And so then, just as these detections of black holes merging, you know, which are pretty incredible and had never been seen before, started to seem a little bit routine and maybe even a little bit pedestrian, it was just a week and a half ago that we had another stunning announcement from LIGO that they had seen a completely new kind of event, that is, two neutron stars merging. And not only had LIGO seen two neutron stars merging for the first time, but this was a relatively close by event, and it had been followed up by an array of telescopes that had seen it across the entire electromagnetic spectrum. So not only do we see this event in gravitational waves, we saw gamma rays from this event, we saw X-rays from this event, we saw optical transients from this event, and we even saw radio waves. This is sort of an amazing follow-up. And this is just a small sampling of the number of observations that are made with telescopes. In this paper here, actually, the table just listing all the observations takes up about 17 pages. And so not only was the number of observations impressive, but this actually told us important new information addressing some longstanding astrophysical puzzles. So I'll get to what I mean by that later in my talk. But first, I just want to say that the future of gravitational wave astronomy looks very bright. So LIGO and Virgo are actually not taking data right now. They've taken their instruments offline and are in the process of upgrading them. So when they reach their design sensitivity, which they hope to do in the next couple years, they'll actually be able to see events that occur about a distance of two farther away. And you'll recall that as the distance goes up by a factor of two, the detection volume, and therefore the number of events, will go up by a factor of eight. And so here I'm showing you the LIGO noise curve, and this is a planned upgrade. And you can see that the frequency which LIGO is sensitive to goes roughly from something like 20 hertz up to a kilohertz, at which point the noise curve starts to go up some. So that point will actually be important for later in my talk. Not only do we have LIGO and Virgo, but there are a number of other gravitational wave observatories that are in the process of being constructed. There's one being built in Japan called KAGRA. There's another one planned for India. And so with this sort of global network of gravitational wave observatories, not only will we be able to increase the number of events we can see, but we'll be able to tell with greater precision where exactly in the sky they're coming from, and continue to do these follow-up observations with telescopes. So of course, you know, this is all tremendously exciting, but it also leads to a number of questions. So one question is, how exactly are these gravitational waves created? What are the sources that give rise to them? Another question is, how can we use these gravitational waves to learn new things about our universe? What new physics can they teach us? And perhaps, you know, most importantly, once we make these observations of gravitational waves, what new questions will they cause us to ask? So in this talk, I'm going to try to address these questions, in particular focus on the kind of theoretical work that I spend most of my time doing, which, fueled by advances in numerical techniques and computational resources, has also sort of undergone a real renaissance lately. So one of the things that I personally find particularly compelling about this field of numerical general relativity, which I'm in, is that it sort of allows us to go beyond thinking of black holes as this sort of passive astrophysical setting upon which interesting events happen. So, you know, instead of thinking of, you know, black hole as this stationary space-time metric in some textbook, as maybe you first come across it in a GR classroom, we can go beyond and sort of make the math come alive and think of black holes as dynamical entities unto themselves. As in, for example, this simulation of the first LIGO detection, where you have two black holes orbiting around each other, emitting gravitational waves at twice their orbital frequency. Oh, more light. Yeah, hopefully you can see that better now. And then as the black holes spiral closer and closer, you get gravitational waves increasing amplitude until they finally merge and create this distorted black hole. So what exactly will LIGO see? So LIGO was built primarily to detect the mergers of compact objects, that is black holes and neutron stars. And we call these objects compact because the escape velocity you need to escape from the gravitational pull of their surface is actually comparable to the speed of light. So far we've seen four mergers of black holes merging with black holes. We've seen one event of two neutron stars merging. At least that's probably what we've seen. So I'll return later in my talk to why exactly I say probably. But you know, as you can see in this pretty amusing comic, Ray Weiss, who will actually be visiting us next month, is making pretty rapid progress going through the LIGO checklist. But besides these mergers of compact objects, there are a number of other, perhaps more rare or exotic sources of gravitational waves that we might see. This includes things like gravitational waves from stars collapsing and going supernovae, or a stochastic background of gravitational waves coming from the early universe or otherwise. And we should also remember that this is a completely new way of looking onto the universe. So it's very possible that we'll see things we're not expecting. We'll just have some surprises. So how do we know what kind of gravitational wave signal to expect from a given source? Or as we've started to do, and hopefully do a lot more of in the future, given some detection of a gravitational wave, how do we figure out about the underlying source that gave rise to it? So in order to do that, we need to solve the equations that Einstein gave us, describing strongly gravitating orbiting systems. So it's not that hard to just write down a solution describing a single black hole or star. But of course, we want to combine these things in binaries and have them undergo interesting dynamics to actually create gravitational waves. And there are various approximations to Einstein's equations that describe things that are not moving too close to the speed of light or where space-time isn't too strongly warped. However, in something like the final stages of two black holes merging, all these approximations break down. And really, we really have no choice but to solve the full nonlinear equations. And so actually, exactly what happens when in the final stages of two black holes merging and what exactly the gravitational wave signal looks like is something that wasn't even known until about 10 years ago. So it turns out the solution required theoretical breakthroughs in numerical techniques, as well as better computational resources to finally address this. So why is this problem so hard? Why did it take so long to be solved? So Einstein's equations actually form a complex set of nonlinear partial differential equations. That's just to say that if you have a solution describing one black hole, you can't superpose it with a solution describing another black hole and get a description of a binary, as you can in Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, where you can superpose things. This problem is also hard because of the range of length scales involved in the problem. So in something like the merger of two neutron stars, you have the individual size of the stars, which is something like 20 or 30 kilometers in diameter. Then you have the distance at which they're orbiting each other, which will be a few hundred kilometers when they enter the LIGO band. And then you have the length scale of the faraway wave zone. You know, when we actually detect these things with LIGO, that's something like 10 to 100 megaparsecs, or 10 to the 21 kilometers. So there's a vast range of length scales that all need to be resolved. Finally, this problem is hard because we don't want to just keep track of the dynamics of gravity. In something like a neutron star merger, we also want to keep track of what the matter is doing. We want to keep track of the flow of the star's material, potentially the magnetic fields that the star may source, radiation, and all these things. And doing so is actually important to fulfilling sort of the promise of multi-messenger astronomy. We need to do this to connect the dynamics of the merger with all the subsequent electromagnetic transients that follow. So just to give you a bit of the flavor of the varied dynamics that these different kinds of compact object mergers are exhibit, I'll tell you a little bit about each of them. And along the way to discussing the mergers of black holes, I also want to take a detour and discuss how black holes can be used as particle detectors to look for a new class of particles through something called superradiance. And I give this as sort of an example of how we can use this new tool of gravitational wave astronomy to actually inform, you know, new theories of physics potentially and connect it to puzzles in other fields like the puzzle of dark matter. And I also just want to mention that, you know, up until the first LIGO detection, we'd actually never seen two black holes even orbiting each other, let alone merging, even with ordinary telescopes. So this is something where having a good theoretical understanding of the dynamics of these systems is essential. So here again is the first LIGO detection from September 2015. But instead of showing you the full signal with all the noise, here I'm showing you a reconstruction of the signal using a full nonlinear solution of the field equations. So you can see the gravitational wave signal is sort of like a sine wave, but with increasing amplitude and frequency as the black holes get closer and closer to each other and orbit faster and faster. And then finally, they merge and you get this distorted black hole, which causes these rapid oscillations which exponentially die away. This is called the black hole ring down. And it's actually this final part that tells us that we have a black hole. For example, when you have two neutron stars orbiting around each other, the gravitational wave signal is actually very similar. So what do I mean when I say a black hole rings? So it turns out black holes are sort of like bells. If you perturb them, you know, either by smashing a star into them or creating an initially distorted black hole by bringing two smaller black holes together, this perturbed black hole will actually oscillate as it settles down to its unperturbed state. And instead of emitting sound waves like a bell, it'll actually emit, of course, gravitational waves. And encoded in the frequency of these gravitational waves is exactly how big the black hole is and how rapidly it's spinning. So now I want to take a little detour and talk about another property of perturbed black holes called superradiance and how this can actually be used to turn black holes into particle detectors. So if we have a spinning black hole and we consider an impinging wave, it can be an electromagnetic wave or a gravitational wave, doesn't matter. if it's this wave is impinging on the black hole with some frequency omega and creating a flux of energy and angular momentum through the horizon. So then let's figure out how that flux will change the area of the black hole's horizon. And if we do that, we get something that's proportional to what I've written here. There's one term involving the change in the mass of the black hole, and there's another term that's 1 minus the ratio of the horizon frequency of the black hole, which is determined by how rapidly the black hole is spinning, the ratio of that to the frequency of the impinging wave. And that's just multiplied by the azimuthal number of the wave. What that means is if the frequency of the wave is below some threshold, this term on the right will actually be negative. However, black holes have a pretty important property, which is that the area of the horizons can never decrease. It can only increase. In the language of black hole thermodynamics, the area actually takes the role of entropy. So this is a version of the second law. But what that means is if this second term is negative, then we need this first term, the change of the black hole's mass, to also be negative in order for the product to be positive. So in fact, waves with this frequency below this threshold actually gain energy from the black hole. And rather remarkably, there's quite a lot of energy in a rotating black hole that can, in principle, be liberated this way. So for example, for a maximally rotating black hole, 29% of its total mass can actually be liberated this way. And so this number actually comes from the difference between the black hole's total mass, the total mass that gravitates at infinity, minus the so-called irreducible mass. And the irreducible mass is proportional to the square root of the area of the black hole, and hence can't decrease, can only increase. So I can show you superradiance in action. So this is a spinning black hole, and it's perturbed by a large amplitude incoming gravitational wave, shown in blue, and then it creates this outgoing gravitational wave in red. And this scattering process is actually 120% efficient. The outgoing wave actually has 20% more energy than the incoming wave.
Is this actual numerical simulation?
Yes, this is not just the animation, it's an actual full calculation. Yeah, so it might not be obvious from this animation, but the black hole spacetime is actually changing as well. So we can measure the horizon properties of the black hole and see. So the case that I just showed you corresponds to these black crosses where the mass of the black hole is smaller after the interaction and the angular momentum is also smaller. And this is in comparison to the red and the blue cases, which had higher frequency gravitational waves and were above the superradiant threshold. So the black hole actually gained energy and angular momentum from interacting with them. Of course, in all cases, the irreducible mass of the black hole is larger afterwards than before, as demanded by black hole thermodynamics. And another interesting thing that you can get out of this sort of full nonlinear calculation is that actually the efficiency of the scattering process in the language of thermodynamics is actually smaller for larger amplitude waves due to nonlinear effects. So in that case, the gravitational wave just interacted once with the black hole and then dissipated away. However, what if you could take a black hole and surround it by a mirror? That way, the wave would be reflected back, interact with the black hole again, grow in amplitude, be reflected back again, and keep growing exponentially until it became so powerful that it exploded through the mirror. And so this is an idea that Preston-Tucholsky actually came up with called a black hole bomb. However, they weren't that successful in weaponizing black holes that way for want of a sufficiently large mirror to surround a black hole. But it turns out there is actually a way to realize this black hole bomb, and that's with massive bosons. So massive bosons In contrast, the massless case can actually form bound states around black holes. That's what's shown here. And these bound states can sit around a black hole and continuously interact with them. So if they happen to have frequency in the super radiant regime, they can indeed grow exponentially in time. So it turns out you can actually use astrophysical black holes to look for ultralight bosons. That is, bosons that have Compton wavelength that's comparable to the radius of the black hole. And we don't actually know of any such particles. But particle physicists have been speculating about a number of interesting dark candidates, things like axions or massive photons, or other particles that interact very weakly with ordinary matter. So these, you know, astrophysical black hole particle detectors are sort of the only way to look for the existence of these particles or rule them out in a way that you just can't do with experiments here on Earth. So this is something that actually Mina and a number of other people here have worked on. So I can show you this super radiant instability in action. So this is a massive vector boson. And I'm showing you the energy density around a spinning black hole. The black hole's spin axis goes right here. So initially, the cloud starts off very small energy and then grows exponentially in time to be quite large. And eventually, it saturates and actually contains a non-negligible fraction of the black hole's mass now in this cloud. So again, it might not have been obvious from that animation, but the black hole spacetime is changing it as well. That's shown in these plots here. So on the left plot, I'm showing you the increase in the energy in the boson cloud and the corresponding decrease in the black hole's mass. And on the right, I'm showing you the same thing, but for the angular momentum. And these different cases just correspond to different values of the boson mass, mu, which is here normalized to the mass of the black hole. So what you can see is that in some cases, quite a lot of energy or mass is being extracted from the black hole, 10% or so. So this is actually important to the nonlinear growth and saturation of the instability. So the reason the cloud actually stops growing at some point is that the black hole is being spun down. So its horizon frequency, which is shown by these blue curves here, is actually decreasing quite dramatically until it matches the frequency of the surrounding boson cloud, which is given by this red curve. So at this point, the condition for super radiance no longer holds, and the instability shuts off. So of course, makes us ask the question, how can we actually observe these boson clouds? So at the saturation of this instability, we have this boson cloud oscillating around a black hole with a frequency that matches the horizon frequency of the black hole. This will actually emit gravitational waves. The gravitational waves are actually pretty simple, as shown in this plot here. They're basically monochromatic, and they have very slowly changing amplitude or frequency that's more or less constant over many, many oscillations. So for example, if we had a boson with a mass of something like 10 to the minus 12 EV and a black hole with a mass of something like 30 solar masses, then the frequency of the gravitational waves from the boson cloud would be around 600 hertz, which would put it squarely in the LIGO band. So one way to look for evidence of these new particles is to look for these boson clouds from the super radiant instability emitting continuous gravitational waves. We can either look for nearby sources that are resolvable, or we could look for a stochastic background of lots and lots of these, a large population of these black holes, which are all developing these boson clouds, which are dissipating through gravitational waves.
Sorry, question. So this would be just right after mergers, right? Because, they keep doing this until they saturate, so it's not going to last forever.
So usually the time scale for the cloud to dissipate by gravitational waves is longer than the time scale for it to grow. So sort of grow, reach saturation, and then emit gravitational waves until you've taken all this energy that used to be in the black hole spin and put it into gravitational waves.
So should we be looking after mergers to see this, or where should we look for this?
Yeah, that's one way to sort of know where to look. You know, right after you merge two black holes, you have a spinning black hole. And you know, if these particles are out there, then it should form a cloud and then start radiating.
Do you have like a template for the kind of signal you should
Yeah, see? Like I said, it's very simple. It's basically just a sine wave.
Okay, just
But you have to integrate it over very long times, which makes it hard. Yeah.
The spins of the merging black holes to primary signature probably to be about 0.6. A is 0.6. So how do you expect to get 0.99?
So I mean that was just one particular case where
what happens to 0.6?
Yeah, I mean, you still get the same effect. So it grows a little slower, basically, and these clouds are a bit less relativistic. They sit farther away from the black hole, but you still get the same thing. But as the spin goes to zero, obviously this effect goes away. But yeah, so that brings in another point I wanted to make. So besides just looking directly for the gravitational waves from these, another thing we can do is look for the effect of the super instability on spinning down black holes. And we can look for that indirectly just by measuring black hole spins. So one way to do that is through LIGO's observation of merging black holes. You know, in the gravitational wave is information about the spins of the component black holes. And then another way is we can just make observations of accretion disks, which also give us a way to measure black hole spins. So now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about neutron star mergers, which, of course, with the announcement a week and a half ago, has become sort of the pressing topic of the day. So neutron stars, which are very compact, can often have very strong magnetic fields or be rapidly spinning, are already suspected of giving rise to a number of electromagnetic transients that we see when we look out into the sky. And so one of the big hopes for gravitational wave observations was to actually be able to do multi-messenger astronomy. That is, to be able to observe the same event both using gravitational waves and electromagnetic signals, and therefore get the most information from them. So related to this, when Fermi or other gamma ray telescopes look out into the sky, they periodically see these very intense bursts of gamma radiation that last about 2 seconds or less. And so a big astrophysical puzzle was actually what is causing these so-called short gamma ray bursts. So a popular theory was that they're due to neutron star mergers. That is either a black hole merging with a neutron star or two neutron stars merging. However, before August, this theory only had sort of circumstantial evidence supporting it. And in fact, theoretical work studying these mergers actually showed that the viability of actually having the right conditions to give you a short gamma ray burst depended a lot on the details of the merger and the exact parameters of the binary. And of course, the sort of smoking gun that would tell us that this theory is correct would be to simultaneously see gravitational waves and a gamma ray burst coming from the same event. And then, of course, as we all know, in pretty spectacular fashion, that's exactly what happened with the first observation of a neutron star merger. So for this event that occurred in August, following 1.7 seconds after the LIGO detection of the neutron star merger, there was a short gamma ray burst detected by Fermi and also by Integral. So now we have fairly convincing evidence that neutron star mergers are at least a source of short gamma ray bursts, if not the unique source. However, in the usual way of important discoveries, this one actually raised a number of new questions. First of all, what exactly sets this 1.7 second delay between the two bursts? Another question, why haven't we ever seen a short gamma ray burst this close before? This short gamma ray burst was actually closer by about a factor of 10 than any other short gamma ray burst whose distance we've measured. So this might indicate that there's some population of fairly nearby short gamma ray bursts that we've been missing, or at least some observational bias in which ones we choose to measure their distance. A related question is,
I take it Fermi was not looking for this because they didn't have time.
That's right. I mean, they definitely detected this before they got information from LIGO. Yeah.
They should have seen the other nearby ones too, had there been ones.
Right, but they don't always know how far, just from Fermi, they don't know the distance. They need some other information to tell that.
So if it wasn't for LIGO, would Fermi have measured, be able to measure the distance to this or not?
Not by itself.
Could it localize in the sky well enough that?
They had some localization just on their own. So some of the Fermi events have been followed up for redshift measurements, but.
This one, they couldn't have.
Yeah. So I mean, there is probably some bias towards, choosing the loudest gamma ray burst to follow up. Yeah. So a related question is, why was this short gamma ray burst so underluminous? It was actually about a factor of 1,000 less luminous than sort of the median short gamma ray burst. And if it were much farther away, we wouldn't have actually been able to detect it. So one possible explanation is just that the radiation from a short gamma ray burst is strongly beamed in one particular direction. We just happen to observe it at a non-favorable angle. So perhaps this is just sort of a vanilla short gamma ray burst, but we happen to see it at a different angle. However, it's also possible that there are a variety of short gamma ray bursts, and some of them have very strong radiation, some are wimpy, as I'll describe to you in a bit more detail later. There's definitely a lot of variability in the outcomes of compact object mergers. And so finally, the sort of big question that we really want to answer is, what is the underlying mechanism of the short gamma ray burst? How exactly do you go from a merger to a short gamma ray burst? And right now, there are a variety of models from having an accreting black hole that gives you electromagnetically dominated jet to having a fireball model or internal shocks. And so definitely right now, there's still a lot of work to sort through these different models and decide which one is the right one. So another reason that that mergers involving neutron stars are especially interesting is that they can actually teach us nuclear physics. So you remember that a neutron star is what happens when you take all the mass of the sun and squeeze it down to roughly the area of Toronto. So the densities inside neutron stars are incredibly high. In ordinary units, they exceed something like 10 to the 15 grams per centimeter cubed. And slightly more whimsical units, like you might find in some cosmic cookbook, this actually means that a teaspoon of neutron star material weighs 1 billion tons. So as you might imagine, we just have no idea what happens at these incredibly high densities. We don't have any access to the behavior of matter in labs on Earth. But actually, the unknown behavior of matter at these high densities, the so-called neutron star equation of state, actually determines how big a neutron star of a given mass is, or things like how massive a neutron star can get before it collapses to a black hole. So the hope is that by actually measuring neutron star mergers and their gravitational wave signals, we can actually learn about the behavior of matter at these very high densities. So to give you a feel for the two possible outcomes for what happens when two neutron stars merge, I'm going to show you two different cases. So one case, two neutron stars merge and immediately collapse to a black hole. You get very little material left over afterwards. Another case, the neutron stars merge, and you actually get what's called a hypermassive neutron star. You get this long-lived remnant that oscillates. You get some matter that's flung out and some matter in this accretion disk. And this so-called hypermassive neutron star can actually last for quite a while, tens, hundreds of milliseconds, maybe even a second or two. And which of these two outcomes occurs actually depends on a number of things. How massive the neutron stars are that emerge, whether or not they're spinning, and this unknown behavior of nuclear matter at high densities, the neutron star equation of state. And it also might be tempting to, for example, connect this delay between the neutron star merger and the short gamma ray burst, this 1.7 second delay, with the possibility of having a hypermassive neutron star that sits around that long. However, right now our understanding of the astrophysical processes giving rise to the burst just isn't good enough to tell that that's the unique reason. It could very well also be that it takes that long for you to build strong magnetic fields with the right topology, or for example, for this jet that's launched to plow through ejected material and finally shine towards us. So something you might have noticed in the second case was that during the violence of the merger, actually some of the neutron star material got flung out. It was actually unbound from the system. So people have studied neutron star mergers across a number of different parameters and found that this is sort of a generic feature. You get something like 1% to 0.1% of a solar mass of ejected material. But where exactly you lie in this range actually depends on a number of things, including the mass ratio of the system, how compact the stars are. So I'm showing you a couple example of the unbound material on these two plots. So this is the amount of unbound material bend according to its velocity at infinity. So you can see that sort of generically you get ejected material that's mildly relativistic. It has a velocity of about 0.2 times the speed of light. However, there's a lot of variability over the different parameters. And for example, if you consider cases with significant neutron star spin, like are shown in this plot, the amount of ejecta can be significantly larger compared to other cases. So as this ejecting material expands, it can actually, since it's neutron rich, these neutrons can actually get captured onto atomic nuclei and build up heavy elements. This is a process known as the R process. These heavy elements then decay radioactively and can actually power an optical transient. This is called a kilonova. And another remarkable thing is that following this first neutron star merger detection by LIGO in August, we did indeed see an optical transient. I actually went from the ultraviolet through the infrared with the characteristics of a kilonova. But here again, this observation raised a number of questions. For example, models of this transient actually suggest that to explain this signal, you need a larger than expected amount of ejected material. So one explanation for this might be that it's actually the post-merger accretion disk that's giving rise to a significant amount of this ejected material. Or it could also mean that we're in an interesting part of parameter space, perhaps with large neutron star spin. Also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention how these mergers are not just figuratively, but literally gold. So, one outstanding puzzle in astrophysics is where do all the heavy elements come from, including our favorite shiny objects like gold or platinum. So we don't actually have the right conditions on Earth to create them. But for a while, the leading explanation was that these heavy elements were actually coming from stars collapsing and going supernova and spewing out these heavy elements. However, especially with this latest detection in August, now it looks very likely that the majority of these heavy elements actually come from this ejected material from neutron star mergers. So perhaps that's a source of funding there. But something that's gotten a little less attention in the media is that actually these neutron star mergers are actually also responsible for things like plutonium and uranium. So turns out we've already built the neutron star bomb. So, yeah.
How much information actually, other than the radioactive stuff or the very valuable stuff, how much spectral information do they have, a catalog of what was produced?
So I think for this one event, the spectra were blurred together in a lot of cases. But I think mainly what they saw were the so-called lanthanides. But I think right now they weren't able to sort of follow up early enough to get out all of those.
Is it possible that some elements were produced that we haven't produced on Earth yet? And if so, would we know?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to, but probably. Yeah, so now I want to talk a little bit about what happens after two neutron stars merge in the case where they don't immediately form a black hole. So here's a zoomed-in version of the merger. You can see there's a lot of complicated dynamics, these small-scale oscillations. And some of them sort of die down after 10 or 20 milliseconds. But in this case, after you wait a while, the star actually develops this sort of funny wobble. This is actually called a one-arm mode. And an interesting thing that we just recently found is that actually in these hypermassive neutron stars that you get from mergers, for a number of different cases, the hypermassive star is actually unstable to this so-called one-arm mode instability. And these oscillations can actually persist for quite a while, for hundreds of milliseconds or maybe even a second. And as you might expect, these oscillations of the star also produce gravitational waves. So I'm showing you the gravitational waves after merger from that case here. So there are two things to note here. One of them is that this looks very different from the black hole merger case, right? You have oscillations that last for many, many cycles, actually much more than I'm showing you here. And in comparison, for the black hole case, the signal dies down exponentially, and there's basically nothing after a few oscillations. However, the second thing to note is that these oscillations are occurring at very high frequency, thousands of times per second. And so, as you recall, this kilohertz frequency regime is where LIGO is not very sensitive at all. So for the August neutron star merger detection, LIGO didn't actually see any of the signal from stars coming into contact or from the post-merger. So if there were any such signal, it was at too high a frequency for them to see. They can only place upper bounds on that. There is, however, potentially quite a lot of information in these post-merger gravitational wave signals.
What you just showed here, would LIGO have seen this?
No.
Just to
fade. Yeah. So there's potentially a lot of information in these post-merger oscillations. So here I'm showing you the gravitational wave strain as a function of frequency. And this is for different neutron star equations of state. So for this part of the N spiral that LIGO would actually see, these different neutron star equations of state would have given essentially identical signals. However, you can see that in the post-merger oscillations, they differ quite a lot in frequency. There's potentially a lot of information there. But even if you have one of these signals that persists for a while, you'll have to be quite lucky to actually see it. I would have to hope for a nearby event or maybe some sort of clever data analysis techniques to combine information from a lot of signals or just for the next generation of detectors. So mainly so far, I've been talking about the mergers of neutron stars. However, it turns out that black holes merging with neutron stars actually show similar types of behavior. So again, the merger of a black hole and a neutron star can give you a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk, which might power a short gamma ray burst. It can also give you ejected material. And whether or not this happens actually turns out to depend on whether or not the star gets torn apart, so-called tidally disrupted, before it gets close enough to the black hole's horizon where the star's material can no longer hang around. It's forced to flow directly into the black hole. This is the so-called innermost stable orbit. And so I'm showing you those two different cases here. On the top, we see the case where the star is tidally disrupted, pulling apart. And on the bottom is a case where the neutron star is more compact and is more swallowed whole by the black hole. So whether or not you get tidal disruption actually depends on a number of things, like the mass ratio of the black hole neutron star system, whether or not the black hole is rapidly spinning, and again, the neutron star's equation of state. And these systems actually show quite a bit more variability compared to the binary neutron star case, with you know, the possibility of the star being completely disrupted and giving you an accretion disk with you know, tens of percent of a solar mass left over possible, but also having the possibility of the star being swallowed whole by the black hole, and you basically just have a bigger black hole at the end and no sort of electromagnetic transient.
I have a question on your simulation you showed previously. Was that gravity plus hydrodynamics plus electromagnetism, or what?
No, so the one I just showed you, that was gravity plus hydrodynamics.
No E&M.
That's right, yeah.
And you talk about hypermassive neutron stars. Theoretically, you go from one solar mass to three solar masses, depending on how exotic the equation state is. But no neutron star has ever been observed with a mass greater than two solar masses.
No.
So you should have had to just, we haven't seen a neutron star with a mass greater than two solar masses.
So these hypermassive, so in a lot of cases, we call these hypermassive neutron stars because eventually they will collapse to form black holes. But they have a differential rotation, and they're actually quite hot because of the you know the violence of the merger. And so that provides extra support that you know it gives you the hypermassive neutron star. And so after it's sort of radiated away, redistributed angular momentum, and cooled down, then it will collapse to a black hole.
But maybe it goes immediately to a black hole.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the cases I showed you. So whether or not you get the hypermassive neutron star or immediate collapse of black hole depends on the equation of state, and within our uncertainty of it, both are possible.
So usually when you have a lot of rotation, you build up magnetic fields.
So one of the things that you would worry about if this, you know, one arm mode instability persists for a second is things like MRI or things like that. So that will definitely have some effect.
Have you tried adding magnetic field?
Haven't actually simulated that. We sort of estimated the time scales on which the MRI would be relevant. It's something like 100 milliseconds, I think. And so that will affect this, but it's not clear exactly how. Just as a illustration of tidal disruption in kind of an extreme case, I want to show you a case where the neutron star is on the larger side and also you have a bit of orbital eccentricity. So in this case, the star gets torn apart by the black hole. You get a lot of material flung out and comes back and then sort of completely disrupted by the black hole. And you get quite a lot of material left over in an accretion disk, you know, something like 10 or 20% of the solar mass, you know, which could power quite a bright transient. Since I told you that black hole neutron star mergers can give rise to similar electromagnetic transients as binary neutron star mergers, and I told you that a neutron star merger actually occurs at high frequencies where LIGO is not very sensitive to it, you might ask the question, how do we actually know that the putative observation of two neutron stars merging wasn't actually due to a black hole and a neutron star merging? So this would be a low mass black hole with a mass of one or two solar masses. So it's natural to suspect that if we have a compact object with a mass of one or two solar masses, that it is in fact a neutron star. know, that's because we've actually seen neutron stars with those masses, and we've never seen a black hole. However, you know, one of the things that we can do with this new tool of gravitational wave astronomy is actually, you know, revisit assumptions that we have that may have been, you know, biased by our available observations. So we could consider the possibility that there's an exotic population of these low-mass black holes having masses of something like 1 to 3 solar masses. These could be formed primordially or by neutron stars being forced to collapse in a variety of scenarios or some other exotic scenario. So this is something that actually Juan, Luis, and I considered in some recent work. And the conclusion we came to is that actually it's quite difficult to distinguish between a binary neutron star merger and a low-mass black hole neutron star merger. So it turns out that the part of the gravitational wave signal that LIGO can see coming from the end spiral of the two compact objects, the leading order effect of having a neutron star instead of a black hole is that the neutron star's companion actually induces a tidal deformation in the neutron star, which causes a little bit extra gravitational waves to be emitted. And that causes the end spiral to happen a little bit faster. So for the LIGO detection in August, they weren't actually able to measure this tidal deformation. They can only place upper bounds on it. However, even if you are able to measure the tidal deformation, there's a degeneracy with our incomplete knowledge of the neutron star equation of state. So that's what's illustrated in this plot. So basically, if you have a neutron star merger, you can have the same leading order tidal effect and a black hole neutron star merger just by making the neutron star of the same mass a little bit bigger. And as you can see from this plot, you don't have to make it that much bigger, something like a kilometer bigger in radius. And then for the final stages of the merger, where the difference between a black hole and a neutron star would be quite strong, that occurs at too high frequency for LIGO to be sensitive to. And there might be important differences in the electromagnetic transients between a low-mass black hole neutron star merger and a binary neutron star merger. However, right now, our knowledge of the underlying astrophysical processes just isn't good enough to distinguish the two. So that's really a sort of a call to arms for the challenges in the age of multi-messenger astronomy. If we really want to get the most new physics possible out of these observations, we want to be able to connect the millisecond timescales of the compact object mergers and gravitational wave signals with the subsequent seconds to days to weeks to months timescales of all the ensuing electromagnetic transients. And we want to be able to tell when we have neutron stars and when they merge, if and when they form a black hole. And to do this, we have to get a good handle on a lot of messy astrophysics, including things like magnetic fields and neutrinos and radiation transport. And this is definitely a hard problem. There are a lot of high-energy transients, which we've been observing for quite a while now, and we still are sort of puzzled about their basic mechanisms. For example, we've observed the Crab pulsar for something like 1,000 years now, and it still continues to surprise us. However, one of the sort of promising new things about multi-messenger astronomy is that we, in some sense, get to see the opening credits to the subsequent light show. So we get to, know where and when this event started, who the main characters are, their motivation is, instead of, jumping in the middle of the movie right when the big explosion happens and not quite knowing what's going on. But there's definitely promise to multi-messenger astronomy. So finally, just before I conclude, I want to say that, though studying the mergers of compact objects and the gravitational waves they produce is, of course, especially interesting right now, these same theoretical and computational tools that I told you about can also be used to address a number of other questions in the strong dynamics of space-time. So just very briefly, I know I mentioned a couple I've thought about lately. That includes questions like, when do black holes form from ultra-relativistic collisions, as there was some worry might happen some years ago when the LHC switched on in scenarios with extra dimensions. So it turns out there's actually some strong gravity focusing effects that lower the threshold for black hole formation by a few. This also includes questions in cosmology, like what happens in a very inhomogeneous universe. So it turns out you can have large inhomogeneities on sort of Hubble scales that give you Hubble scale black holes, but at the same time have expansion elsewhere. So your universe continues expanding. And this also includes questions like, could the Higgs boson have spelled doom for our early universe in scenarios where the Higgs boson is actually unstable at large energies, as the Standard Model predicts? And so it turns out the answer is actually, yes. The Higgs can create these crunching black hole regions of space-time that gobble up all the surrounding space. So I just want to conclude by saying that the future looks very bright for gravitational wave astronomy. You know, of course, the first few detections are very exciting, but all signs point to many more black holes and neutron star merger detections ahead. And there'll be lots of back and forth between the theory and the observations as we hone our models and focus in on the right part of parameter space. We might also hope to see some more exotic scenarios, including things like mergers with some orbital eccentricity or large black hole spin or neutron star spin. And a single event like that could actually tell us quite a lot about the progenitors of these systems, how you actually form these binaries. And then again, we should remember that with this completely new way of looking out to the universe, it's possible that we see something that we just didn't have the imagination to think up. And that'll send us back to our chalkboards to come up with new theories. And of course, that's the most exciting thing about doing physics. So, thank you.
Questions for Will, starting with students.
Very early on, you showed that animation of an incoming gravitational wave extracts energy.
Yeah.
It looked like the outgoing radiation was more isotropic than the incoming. So is it the case that an observer wouldn't see a stronger signal because it just spread out over more solid angles?
I think sort of to leading order, the frequency and essentially that was a quadrupole wave is the same for the ingoing and outgoing. I think that one scenario showed sort of wasn't that astrophysically relevant. It's more sort of a Gedanken experiment to show super radiance in the nonlinear regime.
Did you know how the directions get scrambled for, let's say, a plane wave coming at the...
You don't want a plane wave. You want sort of, you get the maximum effect when you sort of have a quadrupole wave, but it's both a quadrupole in and out.
So in the figure you showed, which you've had this neutron star, and neutron star black holes, you had all the curves there had, you assumed they had the same mass. So did you try when maybe the black hole is half the mass?
So you said?
That one.
Yeah, so.
So you have, so this is, the first one is the same mass and
right, so like, in the binary, you have two neutron stars, and then we're choosing one of those neutron stars to make into a black hole, and then trying to get the same leading order tidal effects. But yeah, we did include changing the mass of the second neutron star. But I mean, so with the gravitational waves, you will be able to, measure to the component masses, and if you have a good signal, you can measure those fairly well. But then it's the tidal effects that are not that well measured. So that was what we were trying to illustrate there.
Is it true that here you assume that the black holes, if you replace this one neutron star by a black hole, it's going to be more massive or equal mass? Is that right?
No, we also included the case where the object, which was the black hole, is either smaller or bigger than the neutron star. It was a neutron star in both cases.
Is there any chance for supermassive black holes colliding on two galaxies?
Yeah, definitely. So I didn't talk at all about detecting gravitational waves in space, but there's an exciting project that will probably happen in the late 2020s called LISA, where they have a gravitational wave detector in space, and that can detect lower frequencies. And so one of the main things they're interested in there is detecting supermassive black holes, orbiting and merging. Yeah.
Pulsar timing arrays are the other way.
Yeah, pulsar timing arrays are another one.
How about the other end? I mean, you talked about these really high frequency gravitational waves being emitted, in the sort of ring down of the neutrons, hypermassive neutron stars. Are those just out of reach for the foreseeable future for detecting those effects? Or, I mean, you said LIGO can't do them as it is, so I'm wondering, does anybody think about these really high frequency gravitational waves?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely would really like to see them because, as I said, there's a lot of physics in there. So I think so far, for the higher frequencies that we detect on the ground, no one has sort of talked about new instruments that might go after those. But one thing is if you just build a bigger LIGO, then you have more sensitivity. I mean, LIGO does have some sensitivity in this, few kilohertz range. But I think that's another thing that would be very interesting, to build some instrument that would just go after the higher frequency range. We're actually discussing at lunch, maybe some sort of bar detector or something like that.
So right near the end, you kind of teased us with this destruction of the universe by the Higgs particle.
Yeah.
Which apparently didn't happen. So.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that? So how early in the universe are you talking about? Is there some gravitational aspect to this, or is it just the usual decay of the false vacuum?
Yeah, so basically the point of that project was to say, if you imagine at some early stage in the universe you're at sufficiently high energies, then you have quantum fluctuations that could kick you, from the electroweak vacuum into this true vacuum, which should occur at higher energies. And so one of the questions was, once you start falling towards this true vacuum at negative energy densities, you'll back react on the expanding space-time, and what exactly happens? There was this idea that maybe, because everything is crunching, this will sort of contribute negligible volume, so even if it's bad for that particular patch, it won't be bad for elsewhere. But what we showed there is that actually it sort of gobbles up all of surrounding space-time, asymptoting to moving at sort of the speed of light. So anything that's past light cone is doomed. So that's
more or less the same thing as you would have seen had you ignored the gravitational effect. Is that right?
I mean, you
can. One would see in flat space.
You get the similar thing if you're in, instead of expanding, you're in Minkowski space. But I mean, you definitely have back reactions from the space time. You're basically forming a black hole and you're going from expansion to contraction in some region.
So what's the probability that that happens? I mean,
yeah, so like,
are you ruling out the standard model or something?
Well, you can only place bounds on that, like in conjunction. So you can place bounds on, for example, inflation occurring at some energy scale and there not being, extra beyond standard model particle physics to stabilize the Higgs. So sort of if you measured, for example, the tensor to scalar ratio at some level, then you could use that to tell you something about particle physics or vice versa.
So did you assume inflation? Does it rely on inflation crucially?
This study was just, it didn't really involve the details of inflation, just you have some de Sitter phase at some energy, basically.
So I guess So I don't quite understand. And usually, I mean, this interface horizons shrink. So even if this expands with the speed of light, it doesn't really do anything. So I mean, if it's just isolated somewhere. So
yeah, so it affects everything in its past light cone, basically. Say another way, like you can't have any of these patches in your past light cone.
Right.
For have our universe as we see it today.
I have a short question. How stable are these numerical solutions? Because you have a highly nonlinear system. So do you always find the same ringing?
Yeah, I mean, so that was sort of one of the reasons that it took so long to get these working, is to find sort of a stable formulation of the Einstein field equations. But I think now we sort of have a pretty good handle on that, where we can, the solutions are stable and we can have a precise measurement of what exactly our numerical errors are and have control over that.
So even though it looks very chaotic, there is no chaos. It's a very regular, predictable.
At least in gravity. I mean, you know, when you have these two stars emerging, there definitely is some small scale stuff, you know, turbulent features and things like that. But yeah, but definitely, you know, like two black holes merging or something like that, there's nothing chaotic about that.
More questions? Okay, well, if there are some more questions, we have Snacks and the Beast. So thanks, William.